Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Ah, yes. Hey there. I am Carol Jurgensen Sheets. Happy Thanksgiving this week. Now, I know you may be in a world of hurt, but there are always things to be grateful for, and I want to remind you of that. You know, your life may feel like a total disaster right now, but if you're listening to this show, you are obviously intent on getting healthier. And so that's the first thing I want to congratulate you on and say, hey, feel good about that. You know, being in recovery means you put the first step forward and you just do the next right thing. And that can be tough because it can feel like it's not enough, but I promise you, it is enough when you continue to do the work that you so badly want to do to get rid of this addiction. Now, obviously in the intro, the big question was, Russell was in a situation whereby he was confronted with opportunities to act out. And my question to him was, do you really want to change that about yourself? And I got to tell you, people that do the work, and it is hard work, but people that do the work, wow, their life changes. And it changes exponentially. You know, I know it can feel like things are getting worse or your wife or husband is complaining more and you just can't do anything right. But I got to tell you, overall, if you're doing the work, your life will get better. And I know that to be true. The Promises says that in the Big Book. And by the Big Book, I'm referring to AA, the 12-step groups that meet and share the 12 steps, all based on the Big Book, which is the book of AA. And I can tell you from my experience and from all of my colleagues' experiences, you can really make a difference in your life if you do the next right thing. And I know you've heard me tell you the 10 recovery tools that you need to follow. And I mean, that is work, but it is so doable. It is so doable. Yes, you have to change your life. Yes, you may have to get up an hour early. Yes, you may have to sit out in the car and do some reading and some writing to have the privacy you need to get it done. Do what it takes. If you're listening to the show, you're already on the road, I'm telling you. I know everybody has different learning styles. It may be that you need to listen to the information that's available. It may be that you need to read it. You may need to do face-to-face. I swear that going to sexual addiction groups, seeing certified sexual addiction therapists, going to 12-step meetings are by far the most effective because you're interacting and participating and substituting for interaction that you've had before. Please know that it will make a difference. You know, and I so appreciate when you all send me emails, you've left me messages, you've written me letters to share that I'm already making a difference in your life. And I've been doing this now. It'll be 3 years in February. I try not to miss a night. On occasion I do, either because of some sort of technical difficulty or a well-earned vacation. But I got the nicest letter, and it was from a woman from New York. I will not mention her name. I don't want to out her in any way. I'll just call her I. And it was two paragraphs long, but listen to what she wrote me. Okay, I'm going to brag on her, but I'm going to brag on me. I'm going to brag on the show, and I'm going to brag on you. She said, "Dear Carol, I have been listening to your show for over a year and want to thank you very much for doing what you do because you're helping a lot of people. You know, that's why I do this. I so believe in getting out the information to you, sharing the experts. I have such a platform to do that, and I am so blessed. It's definitely one of the things that I'm grateful for this Thanksgiving." So she says, and now this is where I'm bragging, "Your empathetic, intelligent presence is very appreciated. May God bless you and your family. Sincerely, I." And I thought, what an amazing letter. It's two paragraphs. It just brightened my day. I said, "Honey," I showed my husband, I go, "look at this. This woman really thinks I'm making a difference." And, of course, he knows I am too, because I know. I've got over 300,000 listeners. I know you're out there. I know you're having trouble, and I know you're afraid to talk about it. And that's what I don't want you to be. I don't want you to be afraid. I want you to go to sexhelp.com. I want you to get the information you need. I want you to put in your zip code. I want you to find somebody who's a specialist. I want you to Google this stuff. I want you to do your reading. I want you to go to 12-step meetings, and if there are none in your area, I want you to do telephone meetings. There are resources out there for you. And if you're a partner, I know how much pain you're in, and I know you're listening to this because you feel so desperate and you don't know if you can take another injury, another wound. And, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this last week on the show, but it's an amazing difference between people that I work with who have been betrayed by infidelity. And, you know, their husbands or wives may have had one or two encounters. And it's tragic. It's painful. Sexual addiction. Because sexual addiction is obviously compulsive and it's obsessive. And the partners can't stop. And the betrayal goes on and on and on until they find the resources. And you know what? Those partners that I meet that are sticking with their spouses, that are going to their meetings, that are reading the material, that are coming to see specialists like myself, they're getting better. And they're hanging in there, and their relationships are better. And that's what I got to tell you. Your relationship will be better. I promise you. If you're doing the work, your relationship will be better, and or you'll have better boundaries, and you'll decide when is enough enough. Doggone it, I wrote this column last month on when is enough enough, and this goes out to the regular community. You know, they're not necessarily sex addicts. But truly, we all ask ourselves at times, when is enough enough? You know, when am I sick and tired of being sick and tired? When do I really feel like I need to start exercising? When do I really decide that I don't want to eat sugar anymore? When do I make the choice to take care of myself? When do I decide that I'm not going to let him or her treat me that way? When do I need to know when to walk away? All those things are decisions you make when enough is enough. And so next week, I will promise you, I will bring this column and I'll read it to you because it's a column I wrote to let you know everybody's got a different take on when is enough enough. But there are certain criteria. You know, the pain level has to be bad enough. I had a man today who's graduating himself from group, and I actually said to him, I said, I'll call him, let's see here, I'll call him Tom. I said, Tom, I know that you know what to do. You know, oftentimes I make a clinical recommendation, you know, don't leave the group, or you're ready to leave the group. It's time for you to graduate, or it is not time for you to graduate. You need the support. And what I knew to be true is that this man had everything he needed to make that choice. And the other guys in group said, oh, man, Tom, we don't want you to leave. We don't think you're ready. You know, you're doing really well, but you need an extra 15 weeks of support. And I smiled because I thought, here are some guys that are really invested in Tom getting healthy and staying healthy and getting that support. Do you have a group? Now, Tom is in my therapy group. That is different than a 12-step meeting. And it can get really confusing. If you've never been to a 12-step meeting, then, you know, 12-step meetings, there is not come in. There may be a topic picked for you. You may get to pick the topic. It may be a big book meeting, which means you read SAA and you learn a principle. Or not. But here's the deal. When you're in a therapy group, you get to bring up your issues. You get to bring up what you want to work on. And in my group, I always ask the guys to identify their primary feeling, because what I know to be true is that it is really hard to know how we feel. And when you do know how you feel, that can make all the difference in the world. And so I limit it to 5 feelings: anger, sadness, loneliness, fear, and happiness. And they first have to identify how do they feel. Then they have to check in their week in 3 sentences or less. And then they have to talk about what they want to work on, how many recovery days they have. And then we may do a group exercise or an individual exercise. You know, it's an opportunity for people to get their needs met. And although groups can feel very, very scary for the average person, I got to tell you, you know, what groups offer is a different kind of fellowship than 12-step work. They're both invaluable. They're wonderful. But in groups, you can really identify how can I customize my life and change behavior, especially around sexual addiction. So what I would encourage you to do is to go to sexhelp.com, put in a zip code that you're currently living in or working in, and seeing if any of the CSATs in your area offer groups. Patrick Carnes says it's instrumental in making the changes that you need to make to have a good therapist and to have a good group. So that's my spiel. I really believe in this. Now tonight, we're going to be talking to a Christian sex therapist, and he came highly recommended to me, so I reached out to him. His name is Phillips Wang, and he actually works out of Indianapolis, which is where I'm from, if you remember. And he really believes in living life to the full and integrating Christian spiritual beliefs and practices to aid in recovery. So he has a wealth of knowledge. And being a Christian sex therapist, he comes from that perspective. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to hear the kind of information that he has to share with his clients? And then you can think about, gosh, do I want a Christian therapist, a Christian sex therapist, that might actually be a better fit for me? Because, I know that churches are sometimes our very first referral source to making a difference in getting people to the right counselors. So I really appreciate Philip coming on and sharing his expertise. And so I want to welcome you to the show. Philip, how are you?
I'm doing well, Carol. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I am excellent. You know, it's Thanksgiving week, and so I'm a big believer, and if you want to be happy, you got to stay in the moment, you got to have gratitude for what is, and obviously this week reminds us of that, and then you've got to be able to look at your life and go, okay, how am I growing stronger? And I really liked your perspective. I loved your brochure on sexual and intimacy problems. It seems like anybody who would work with you would feel very, very comfortable. So can you tell me initially, how did you get involved in the field of sex therapy and Christian philosophy?
Yeah, that's a great question. If I can start with, Carol, I very much appreciate you asking me to be on your show. It's an honor and a privilege, so thank you for the opportunity.
Oh. Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, so the question of how I got into Christian sex therapy is maybe an interesting one. I think prior to my experiences going to grad school, I had worked with different populations. I had known that I was supposed to work with people, so I had worked in places like a substance abuse treatment center. I've worked in psychiatric hospitals. I worked in a Christian boarding school for at-risk teens, so just a lot of different settings. And there's always something about me that was kind of drawn towards things that were difficult. And I recall working with folks who were sex offenders. I remember being in groups with sex offenders, you know, just with accompanying some of the teens I was working with or things of that sort, or working in a halfway house. And to me, it always seemed like a very difficult issue. And something that I had a lot of grace for. And so going into grad school, my goal was not to become a Christian sex therapist as much as it was to become a Christian counselor per se, and to be very sound with my clinical training. And my original plan was to work with children and teens. And I remember taking an introductory class in human sexuality. And I came away from that weekend just kind of blown away. I remember coming home and just even like telling my wife, like, hey, it's okay if you go and spend some, you know, spend more money on getting some nice haircuts, because that's an important thing. Just the idea of sexuality being a healthy thing, and just having an experience of that in this initial class that I took was very profound to me. And so as I thought about it some more, I just remember telling my wife, like, I think this is my calling to work with this population. And to be very honest and frank with you, Carol, I mean, I've struggled with my own things. You know, I've gotten counseling, I've gotten help. And so, you know, all these things kind of relate on a personal and a professional level. And so, you know, what I did over time was I saw the calling and I tried to match the calling with training and experiences. So that's kind of part of my journey into how I got into this field.
Well, I appreciate your honesty, because I know that the majority of CSATs, which are certified sexual addictions therapists, also have been in recovery from sexual addiction and really felt a calling based on their own struggles to take their life to the next level and help people. And obviously that is the premise of 12-step work, and it's paying it forward and serving fellowship. So appreciate the fact that you could share that about yourself. Now, obviously, you just described who you are and what you do. What is a Christian therapist, a sex therapist? I mean, tell me a little bit about that, because you said initially you wanted to help people.
Right, yeah. First, it sounds like an oxymoron. I think when a lot of people think of the word Christian, sex is not, you know, something that you associate with the word Christian. So if I can start with, let me describe what a Christian therapist or a Christian counselor is, and then I'll kind of move into what a Christian sex therapist is. So I'll just kind of explain myself and my training. So as a Christian counselor, I'm clinically trained as a marriage and family therapist. That's what my degree, my coursework is in. In addition to this training, the graduate school I went to involved a lot of training in applied Christian theology and integration of Christian beliefs and counseling into counseling practices, as well as the use of spiritual formation. So a lot of very intentional work with theology and spiritual formation. There, I think you'll find a lot of folks who are counselors and Christians, but I think finding counselors who are trained in integration becomes even more relevant. And so I was thankful enough to have the opportunity to get some really good training. So that's kind of the first piece of what a Christian counselor might look like. A Christian sex therapist is essentially, this is something that I wrote. A Christian sex therapist applies Christian beliefs and values into the treatment of sexually related issues from a Christian worldview, where sex is viewed as God's wonderful creation to be enjoyed within his boundaries, with the belief that God can redeem those who are sexually broken. Practically, in terms of actual training, I have the same amounts of training that a regular sex therapist might receive, but my training was taught within parameters of Christian values and beliefs. So that's clinically, it's as sound, but it's just kind of the perspective it's taught from is slightly different. And I would say I think most folks I would work with, and I would think a lot more folks than not would agree with Christian principles than not. For example, that fidelity is an important thing in a relationship. My undergraduate was at Indiana University, where, of course, the Kinsey Institute is located at. And I remember in my undergrad school days that I had a friend who was working with the Kinsey Institute, and she was just embarrassed by some of the videos she had to watch. So as a Christian sex therapist, I have some values and beliefs about things that I think are healthy and blessed by God.
So then tell me, obviously you had the schooling from Indiana University and you had the desire to promote Christian principles and values and beliefs and look at things from a biblical standpoint. Do you work with people who are not Christians?
I absolutely do, yeah. I think I've had a lot of experiences working with a lot of folks. So one of the things I try to be, just as a counselor in general, is I want to be effective and I want to be compassionate. I feel like if someone walks away from an experience, a counseling experience, and they can feel like, I think like he cares about me and what we're going to do is effective, then I've done my job well. So I feel like in that respect, even if someone isn't, if that's not their worldview, that I can respect them and I can see them with grace and compassion. I've had clients who have told me, even with very different views, that they feel very safe and comfortable with how I've treated them and just the respect that I've given them. So it's definitely something that, I absolutely will work with folks who don't have a Christian perspective. I also want to say that there's kind of an idea that that a therapist or a counselor ought to be values neutral, and I don't really believe in that idea. I think everyone comes to the table with their values and beliefs. From my understanding, the field of psychology is the most atheistic of all the science areas. So that being said, I think it's unusual for a counselor to have perhaps some religious values and beliefs.
I'm so glad you said that, because I have always referenced higher powers, God, even biblical scripture in my work, knowing that ethically I'm not allowed to and I'm not supposed to, and that
right.
I take a risk in doing that. But I felt like that is, A, who I am, and B, I would never impose my values on anybody.
Absolutely.
But when I know that they're Christian, it really helps to be able to share that kind of camaraderie. And yet you're right. I mean, we are obligated ethically not to do that. So you obviously get, you have that option, and I applaud you for taking that. I really do believe for probably, at least here in Indiana, at least 70% of my clients, they want to know that somebody has some biblical basis or some scriptural value. And I get that maybe if we were in the West Coast or the East Coast, it might not, well, it's not the Bible Belt there, but at the same time, there are plenty of people that ascribe to it and ascribe to other values that we can also support.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, just ethically as a counselor, you know, we're taught to do no harm. We're taught to, you know, help people as best we can. And, you know, and so something I do with clients is, I mean, some clients come in and they see me and they're very overtly looking for that integration piece. And but what I do with all clients, and I'll kind of, you know, weigh this out, that if I sense a client is desiring this, I'll explain what it is and I'll ask them. And I'll get some verbal informed consent. So it's not something that, even within the bounds of me knowing that a client is wanting this, I will still get their permission and document that, because that's just being ethical.
So I think being ethical
is really important.
You do a lot of talk about integration in your work. So explain, what is integration and why is this relevant?
Yes. Integration simply, as I'll define it, is the application of Christian beliefs and spiritual practices into a client's counseling process. I have a paper that I wrote in grad school. I believe it's like 29 pages long, and it describes my view of integration. And I don't go through 29 pages with clients. So what I usually describe is integration practically. What that looks like is I will operate from a Christian worldview. I may talk about biblical ideas or concepts. I may mention or discuss Bible passages or verses that's relevant to a client's treatment. I might discuss and assign use of spiritual formation practices to aid in the client's emotional and spiritual growth. And I might even pray for clients. Again, I think there are clients who present to counseling seeking out the specialty. And I think those who do find comfort and relevance in this shared belief, knowing that I operate from their same worldview.
Okay, so that's integration. It's really being able to use a variety of modalities that helps a client to integrate Christianity into their own life's issues.
Right, specifically into the counseling process. And, you know, I tell clients, like, you're not coming to pay me for an expensive Bible study. You know, that's not the focus of the treatment per se, but it's a value added part of the treatment that they can choose to have.
You know, I think for a lot of clients, to be able to talk with a Christian therapist, especially a Christian sex therapist, about sex addiction is especially healing, because they already feel horrible about their actions and what they're doing. And they feel like they have spiritually wronged their families, their spouses, and God. And so to be able to talk to somebody who represents that institution, it really can be a healing experience. You know, that's why they go and talk to their pastor first. You know what I mean?
Right, yes. Yeah. Yeah, some people do. And Carol, early on, my dream job per se was to work in a church setting and do counseling out of a church setting, and there are pros and cons to doing that. In many respects, I'm thankful to be in a private practice setting, because I think there are some folks who, maybe because of bad church experiences or spiritual abuse or things of that sort, a church might not be the safest place for a person to go to at first. You know, so I'm thankful for you know, for an opportunity to still practice within those realms and provide some safety in that respect.
And yet you probably get so many referrals from churches. I mean, because they have faith in you that you're not going to mislead a client and you're going to hopefully guide them through their own spiritual beliefs.
Yeah, that's certainly the hope.
Now, let me ask you, do you ever work with agnostics or atheists?
Yes, I believe I have. I don't know if we've talked about like openly about their atheism. But yeah. I mean, frankly, you know, a lot of people when they present the counseling, I mean, they're just broken to begin with. And I, you know, I can understand why, if maybe a person was, you know, spiritually abused or just abused, period, would have issues with God. Looking back, I think that's been the case where I have worked with folks with some of those beliefs. It's obviously it doesn't become a focus of counseling, and we're focusing on other things, like treating depression or whatever else, or sexual issues. But yeah, I think I have.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because clearly I worked in an abuse program years ago, and I treated all the perpetrators, all the survivors and their family, and it was for a county, and they wanted us to keep the children safe but also keep the family together if at all possible. There were many, I would say at least 40% of my clientele, they were angry with God that the abuse had happened, and they didn't understand. And so when you said that obviously some people have been betrayed by their church, betrayed by a pastor, or even betrayed by abuse, I mean, when bad things happen, it's easy to go, God, why did you let this happen to me? And I'm sure you deal with that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you hear people's stories, and some stories are just horrific, and it's like, I would have issues too with God. And so I think just having that understanding of just looking at someone compassionately and having some grace and knowing that they may be in a spiritual process, but, you know, at this point in time, you know, there may be a lot of anger or some distance, and, you know, that's okay. I think I encourage people who are open to really press into some of those feelings. You know, if they're angry with God, that they really try to express that, and knowing that God can handle their anger, that God can handle the questions. You know, there's a whole field of study in this called theodicy. I took a whole class in it when I was in grad school. That's a study of how you reconcile the goodness of God with bad things that happen.
That's interesting. You know,
really
say that one more time. What's it called?
It's a big word called theodicy. And
I'm gonna look it up.
Sure, yeah. There may be a nicer definition or a more elaborate definition that you can find, but that's essentially what it is. When bad things happen, how do you reconcile the goodness of God with these bad events per se?
Absolutely. So now, if someone is approaching you for help due to their own specific struggle with sexually addictive behaviors, what are some things that you do to help them?
There are, yes. And some of the things I do are, I mean, just to be frank, are just very guided by, I think, good clinical practice. When I meet with the clients, the first thing I like to do outside of going through an informed consent so they know what's going on is just build a safe therapeutic relationship. I think it's Salvador Mnuchin who said that the goal of the first session is to get a client to come back for the second.
Uh-huh.
And
exactly.
I think that's done through building a lot of rapport, hearing a person's story, creating a safe environment for them to just start sharing what they're dealing with. So initially, I want to build that safe therapeutic relationship, ask questions, get them, you know, get to really know a person's story and where they are at this kind of this glimpse in time. After that, I will do some emergency crisis care as needed, depending on how severe a person is presenting in terms of their sexual issues. I will, along the lines, assess their sexual functioning. I'll assess their mental health functioning. You know, with sexual addiction, it's not uncommon to have some co-occurring disorders. Like ADHD is highly correlated with sexually addictive behaviors. You know, depression is often co-occurring, substance abuse. So I think being able to rule out some of these things and see if they're present in a client's life. And then I'll also work on stabilizing, if a person's in a marriage or in a relationship, I'll help them stabilize some of those relationship issues in the beginning to get them functioning better at the onset of things. We might put some boundaries in place, you know, put some filters on their devices to if they're acting out is very severe and that's just, you know, something that they're strongly struggling with. At some point in time, early in the process as well, I will try to assess a client's commitment to change, which I think is real important. I think it's Carnes who asked this question of, do you want to get well? You know, simple question, but very profound if you really think about it. You know, and I tell people, like, you may, that there's different ways to getting well. You may kind of have this objective, this end goal of, yes, I want to get well, and you're just kind of working towards that goal. Other folks, I kind of tell them, like, hey, if you're not quite sure yet if you want to get well, get started in the process and let the process kind of lead you. Trust the process without knowing the full outcome per se.
But it's interesting you would say that because in a similar vein, we in addictions knew, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, you could not change for somebody else. You had to change for yourself. And yet
absolutely.
Now what we're seeing is, oh, no. At the beginning of the crisis, when you're sick and tired of being sick and tired and you are ready to change, you can change for your wife or your husband because once you get involved in that process, again, that transformation occurs and you turn it around from them or them to yourself. So it matters not what's the motive. You just start doing the next right thing.
Yeah, it's kind of there's a family systems concept called equifinality. And what that means is it doesn't matter where you start because you'll end up in the same place. So
mm-hmm.
I think for recovery
exactly.
In many respects, I'm kind of like, well, maybe you're here because you got caught by your wife and you're in trouble. And you're kind of appeasing
mm-hmm.
your spouse. You know, along the lines, along the recovery process, you may kind of realize, hey, you know, I'm worth it to do this for myself. So I, you know, that change can happen. And, you know, so however a person presents, you kind of meet them where they're at. And along the way, you hope for some deepened change. If I can continue with my answer, some other things I might do is, In the early recovery process, I'll introduce different concepts and interventions to establish abstinence from acting out behaviors and, you know, really help a client think through the process of committing to recovery. As you know, Carol, the first 6 months to a year is very, very difficult for a client who's in sexual addiction recovery. So, you know, that first year just trying to stop acting out behaviors, trying to stabilize their life and their relationships and things of that sorts. And another thing that I think is important to do with clients is addressing other sexual or non-sexual issues as needed, and even helping clients learn how to live in a healthy way. You know, there might be issues like work-life balance issues or teaching a client effective financial management or, you know, improving communication effectiveness through marriage counseling, learning about healthy sexuality, growing spiritually. You know, maybe a person is very isolated. They need to build some community or support system, addressing past abuse issues and, you know, things of those sorts. So that's kind of a small picture of what I might do with a client who presents for counseling with sexual addiction issues.
So how often do you refer them to SAA or SA or Celebrate Recovery.
Right, yeah. I will refer a person very often because I think success in recovery is often a multifaceted approach. Carol, I was listening a little bit to what you're chatting about before I came online tonight, and you were talking about groups. And I'm a big fan of groups. I think groups do something that individual counseling can't do. And so I really, you know, promote that clients seek out some kind of group experience, whether it's through a 12-step group like SA or SAA, or if they seek it out through something like Celebrate Recovery. You know, I know of some other groups in Indianapolis, some recovery groups, and I even started a recovery group of my own sometime earlier this year. So, you know, I very much value the benefit of a group, and I will talk through different options and different types of groups with clients. So, yes, I believe in groups very highly. I think they're a great resource, especially with a lot of groups being low or no cost. I think it's a great place to start, or a great place to fall into along the lines of your recovery process.
Well, I would 100% agree with that. And, you know, it's interesting. When I got trained with Patrick Carnes, the two questions I asked him were, would I be a better therapist if I were in recovery for sexual addiction? In other words, was this going to be a disadvantage for me because I don't have this issue? And he said no. And the second thing I said is, does it matter that I'm a woman? And he said, no, absolutely not. But he says, I'll tell you one thing that you need to provide as a therapist, regardless of recovery or not, regardless of your sex. He says, you will not be doing a good job as a therapist unless you are offering to these men and women therapy for sex addiction. And I thought that was, you know, obviously he knew that that was imperative to their care. And for me, the group therapy is different than 12-step work. I mean, they're both valuable. There right. aren't enough groups being offered, so I am excited to hear that you offer one too. And it sounds like this is a men's group that you offer for a variety of issues?
It's a men's group focused on sexual addiction recovery. So it's very,
wow.
very specific.
Excellent. Boy, I'm thrilled to hear that. We just don't have enough of that going around. So is it Christian-based? Do you look at spiritual transformation?
Yeah, originally the group was designed to be to have Christian influence with participants open to Christian ideas. They don't necessarily have to be a Christian. And, you know, I think, as you probably know with groups will kind of develop into their own thing. And I think my group has developed into such where it's very spiritual formation based, where my group members are usually fairly mature in their spirituality as they're presenting the counseling. And so I've utilized some of those practices to really further form and shape the group that I currently have. But, you know, one thing I really want to do was promote a lot of safety, promote a lot of honesty. You know, because I've run groups in non-therapeutic settings. And to me, safety is always paramount. You have to feel safe in a group to be able to be vulnerable and be able to share. Kind of like what I caught you saying earlier too, before I got online with you is, when I tell clients is, yeah, groups are oftentimes maybe the hardest thing for you to start in your recovery process, but I think they can also be the most rewarding.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously, again, you work from a variety of premises, and I asked you earlier, what does integration mean? And so I'm going to ask you, from your perspective, what does spiritual formation mean to you?
Sure, yes. So I was thinking through how to best answer this. That would be concise. And so a definition I came up with, spiritual formation is the process of engaging in various spiritual disciplines to help orient yourself into becoming more of the person God created you to be. So spiritual formation work might include working with a spiritual director. This mm-hmm. person would journey with you in hearing God and discerning practices that may be helpful for you. And spiritual formation might include practicing spiritual disciplines. And there's a variety of different disciplines you can practice. And as I kind of see with different clients, even clients who are, have been Christians for a long time, as part of spiritual formation, part of the appeal of spiritual formation to me is you get to practice how to be with God versus just doing for God. I think a lot of people get caught up in just how many things can I do, how many people can I serve. And while that stuff is very relevant, I think just being with God can be very important too.
Absolutely. And, obviously this has been a calling for you for a long time. And so were you brought up religiously? Did you have a spiritual background in your family?
Actually, I didn't. I have a very interesting, story about how I came to know Jesus as my Savior. But essentially such that, I guess the short version is I had some friends a friend and his family that were praying for me, praying that I would become a Christian. And we had a Gideon's Bible in our home, one of those Bibles that you might find in a hotel. I remember being a little kid and I would, feel a certain way. So I'd try to look something up in a Bible and I didn't know what I was doing. It was pretty funny looking back. And so along the ways in my early teen years, I was just going through some tough times, and I think between my friends praying, like him and his family praying for me, I just randomly decided to want to go to church one day. So I started attending a church, and I basically chose the nearest church that I can ride my bike to. And I started meeting with someone who would share with me God's love for me. We'd meet after church, and we'd just kind of go through the basics of Christianity. And then between him and two other men growing up in my teenage years, I had some really good mentors, per se, who taught me a lot about what it really looked like to live out the Christian faith. And I was always kind of like a middle-aged man when I was a teenager. I was very, emotionally mature for my age. So I don't know, a lot of those things just really made a lot of sense to me. And as I've kind of explored things more as I've gotten older, it just makes a lot of sense to me. I think my beliefs are very, academically sound if you were to examine the actual beliefs. But at the same time, on a very emotional level, I know that God just loves me very deeply. And that's something that I'd, try to spend my life conveying to other people.
It's nice to hear about your background. Now, I got some specifics for you. I'd like to know, clinically, what are some spiritual formation practices that you think be helpful for someone who's in recovery?
Absolutely. And I have a very long answer for you, Carol.
Okay.
There is...
I'm ready.
Sure. The first, there are more practices than the ones I'm going to list. I'm just going to list a couple. So silence and solitude, I find are helpful in discerning truth in your life. I have a quote from Mother Teresa, and she one time said, "God speaks in the silence of the heart. Listening is the beginning of prayer." So again, God speaks in the silence of the heart. Listening is the beginning of prayer. So I think in that place of silence and solitude, that in this place of listening to God, that you can kind of, at times, that can be coupled with prayer. A lot of spiritual disciplines, what you'll find is they kind of overlap with each other. You might do silence and solitude, and at the same time find yourself praying, and that's absolutely okay. So that's one practice per se. I think the practice of the Sabbath is a really great practice for a lot of folks in recovery. And to me, the practice is, or the Sabbath is about learning how to rest. It's learning how to play. It's learning to trust God in your rest. It's learning to enjoy things that were once ignored. I think for someone who's struggling with sexually addictive behaviors, you know, oftentimes what they'll do is if they face some kind of challenge, they'll cope just by sexually acting out. It becomes like a primary and in a very limiting way of coping. So I think practicing something like a Sabbath allows a person to tap into that side of them where you foster a lot of just being like a kid where you get to play. I think a Sabbath is best established when you discern things that you will not do, and you also establish things that you will do. It's funny, I think it's in Jewish culture, you get extra bonus points if you had sexual intercourse with your spouse on the Sabbath.
Well, you do. You get extra bonus points.
Yes, yeah. So I think the Sabbath is a fun practice. Bible reading is something that I think can be done to nourish your soul, give you guidance, and encourage you with hope. I think that being said, there's a lot of different ways to read your Bible. I think for a lot of folks who are in North America, you know, Bible reading becomes very evangelical, where we taught to just kind of read our Bible and to read it in a way where you just study it. And that's obviously one way to read it, and there's great value to studying and knowing what you're reading. There's other ways to read the Bible. You can read it meditatively, for example. You can pick out a passage or a verse and just meditate on that. There's practices like Lectio Divina, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And that's mm-hmm. another practice where you intentionally focus on some verses and you let that kind of soak into your soul. Another practice is just this idea of honoring the body. And it's simply attending to and caring for our bodies and our needs. I think there's this philosophy called Gnosticism. And what that means very roughly is your body and your soul and spirit are separated. And what's been heretical about that in church history is that if you separate your body from your soul, then it's almost like you can do whatever you want with your body because it's separate from your soul and your spirit. So technically, if someone who's struggling with sexual addiction, they might be able to say, well, I can do whatever I want. I can have sex with whoever I want and, you know, do whatever sexual practices I want. It doesn't really matter because it's separate from my spirit. So I think honoring the body is being attentive to caring for your body in practical ways, just like, you know, gaining enough sleep, eating well, getting exercise. I think that can be a spiritual practice, because you're caring for your body, and your body is just another part of who you are. There's a practice of self-examination, and one specific way of doing this is praying. And I've been studying this recently, and I like making worksheets, and I put together a worksheet about the prayer of examine. This is based on some Jesuit traditions, and prayer of examine is something that you do daily or weekly, and you basically have a series of questions, and you just kind of reflect through your day. So it's a way of becoming self-aware about yourself and about God's presence in your daily or weekly living. There's what's called a rule of life. This is a Benedictine concept. And a rule of life is simply kind of like a recovery plan. It's you're taking these different spiritual disciplines and you're crafting it into some habits and some rhythms that you can practice daily, that you can practice weekly or monthly or even seasonally or yearly. They can be things that are spiritually focused, or they can be very practical things. I was reading out of a book, this person's rule of life, and this author would write about how she wakes up in the morning, and the first thing she does is she checks her smartphone for emails, and she kind of realized that that's maybe not the best way to start my day. So part of her rule of life is I don't check my smartphone before 9 a.m. in the morning or something like that. And you start your day with some other type of practice that's more nourishing to you. So it can be very practical things like that. It can be other things where maybe you practice a self-examination prayer at every evening. Maybe you practice fasting. I have a close friend of mine. He will practice fasting on Wednesdays. He'll not eat lunch, and he'll just pray for all his clients. And so that's part of his rule of life, per se.
Absolutely. I really believe in that. Have you heard of the Ho'oponopono method?
I'm not familiar with that, no. Can you explain it?
Well, and I just ask you that because it is a psychiatrist in Hawaii who treated the inmates who were serial killers, I mean, very violent and aggressive crimes, by praying for them and saying four very simple statements. And they were, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I love you, and thank you. And he would read their charts, and he would keep saying those things to the patients, to the criminals, and he never saw them. And these people got better. They became less violent. They became more integrated in their social skills. And again, it was that quiet, reflective prayer, that vibrational energy, that connection with God that healed them. And so when you said your friend did that, you know, I have no doubt that that kind of prayer really makes a difference. Been fascinating to talk to you, and we're not even done with the interview, but would you tell our listening audience, for anybody who's local that would like to work with you, how might they get a hold of you?
Yeah, probably the simplest way is you can email me. My email address is simply my first name. It's Phillips, Phillips, the @ and then sorestcounseling.com. That's sorestcounseling.com. You can also find all my contact information on my website, which is www.sorestcounseling.com. It was kind of funny, Carol, when I was trying to come up with the domain name, I'm like, the name of my practice is Sojourner's Rest Counseling. And I'm like, no one's going to spell Sojourner's right. Or, you know, it might be a hard word to spell. So I'm like, I'll just make it So Rest. And it's kind of a play on words, kind of like, So Rest.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. And
that's
so,
kind of
course,
a funny way to
my listening audience, if you don't have a pen or pencil available, you can always email me at carolthecoach@aol.com, and I will forward your request to Phillips. Phillips, it has been wonderful to get to talk to you. I had no idea that you worked in sexual addiction so devoutly, and so just know that I will be sending people your way, and I would love for you to come back on the show sometime and kind of finish up this interview and share some more of your hope, strength, and wisdom with my listening audience.
Well, I thank you again, Carol, so much for the opportunity, and and my hope is that maybe someone needed to hear something that we had to chat about tonight, and that provides them a sense of hope, or maybe that provides them a sense of, hey, maybe I should get started in this recovery process. If anyone can be helped through this, then it was, very much worth the time.
Oh, I agree with you. Thank you so much. And we'll keep in touch.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity again.
Absolutely. You take care and have a great day.
You too.
Well, as you heard, that's Philip Lang, and he actually has Sojourner's Rest. It is a counseling practice where he treats anybody. He specializes in marriage and couples counseling and recovering from infidelity and couples sex therapy and sexual addiction, as well as bipolar and depression, anxiety, grief, family issues, and, of course, spiritual issues. And if you need to get a hold of him, he can be reached at Phillips, it's P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S, at SorestCounseling.com, S-O-R-E-S-T, Counseling.com. And obviously he has a website there too. So I appreciate you hanging in there and finding out more about sexual addiction and the treatment out there. Addiction counseling is so important. And I want you to come back next week. We are going to be talking to a hypnotherapist who specializes in treating sex addiction. I cannot wait to interview her. I had her actually set up for about a month and a half ago, and the lines went down because of a storm hitting New York. So I'm going to be interviewing Suzanne Hillner Zink, and she has Dawning Visions Hypnosis and specifically treats sexual addiction. So once again, as I say at the end of every show, you know what? There will be only one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we'll look forward to hearing what your gratitudes are this week and next. And you guys know, whether you're an addict, whether you're a partner, or whether you're just interested in finding out more about this, I have a lot of gratitude for you. Have a great week.